Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think if you asked a lot of men, they would probably say like, oh, I would never assault someone and I don't know anyone who would. Like, none of my friends would do that. But then one in three women have been assaulted, and a huge majority of that, the perpetrator is known to the victim. So someone is doing it, and someone we know is doing it.
Hello and welcome to Love Lives, a podcast from The Independent where I, Olivia Petter, speak to different guests about the different loves of their lives. Today, I am so excited to be joined by debut author Ella Lee to discuss her book, Jaded. So, welcome, Ella.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, as I mentioned in the intro, you started writing this book in the middle of the pandemic, like zero book experience prior to that. You were working in a law firm, presumably incredibly busy by that. So what was it that led you to decide to, like, you know, use the little spare time I presume you had to write a novel?
Well, the story was like percolating in my head for a really long time, and I'd been sort of ruminating on all of these like anecdotes and conversations and whispers and experiences that, you know, you just get kind of really, really small snapshots of, but you'd never get the chance to properly linger on. And then the pandemic hit and, you know, I was kind of alone for the first time with like the culmination of all of these things, and for the first time considered them in the round. And altogether, they just seemed so egregious that I like needed an outlet for it. And I kind of didn't really expect to write a whole novel. I just wrote that first opening scene at the work party. And that scene has kind of remained like pretty much largely unchanged from like the very first day I wrote it. And from there, I just couldn't stop. And in terms of sort of working around law, I was writing it in secret. So no one knew. And I was just doing it in my evenings and weekends and just kind of just, I got a bit obsessive about it, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone who is trying to write a book, but that was kind of how I got it done in the end.
And so you wrote a first draft. In how long did that take you to do?
About, I want to say like a month. It's kind of like a really like fuzzy period, but yeah, around a month. Yeah.
Wow, that's so interesting. And so after that, at what point did you decide this is something that I actually want to put out there and get published? Or was that kind of always the intention?
It wasn't always the intention, mainly because, as you said, I just had no understanding of how like publishing worked. So I just had no idea if that was even like possible. But I think as it started to take shape and as I started to kind of create something out of it and create, you know, form Jade a bit more and sort of her character, I was a bit like, what am I going to do with this? What is the purpose of this? And that's when I kind of thought, okay, like maybe I should at least just try putting it out there with kind of low expectations. So I sent the first query email to agents on the morning of my wedding.
Wow. because
I was just like, well, I can't get any more stressed, so I'm just going to like do this and then just like hope for the best and then just kind of forgot about it until I very, very happily heard back. And then, yeah, it just kind of went from there.
Amazing. And so tell us the story of Jaded. I know we got a kind of flavor of it from the prologue, but who is Jade and what is that first kind of work scene that you briefly mentioned that takes us on this journey?
So Jade is a 20-something lawyer who kind of seemingly has kind of what she's always wanted. You know, her life centers around her quite, you know, career that's going quite well, her really long-term relationship and her family. And then something, you know, quite life-changing happens to her right at the start of the book, and that acts as the catalyst for her to kind of unpick this life that she's thought was perfect. And in parallel with her coming to the realization that she has been assaulted, she almost has this like parallel realization that she really hasn't belonged in this life that she's so carefully created for herself.
It's really interesting putting those two things next to one another and seeing the way that the book unravels from that initial assault. It's also just so wild because I know we've spoken about this before, but like we have both, I've covered a similar sort of conversation in my novel that hasn't come out yet. But it's interesting that this is something that isn't really talked about that much, given how common an experience it is. And I don't just mean sexual assault. I mean this concept, this thing that I'm going to call blackout sex, which is not remembering sleeping with someone for, you know, various reasons, usually alcohol or drug related. And it's interesting because I think that in popular culture, that is something that is often used as like comedy fodder. So it's sort of like, oh, lol, you woke up next to someone you can't remember.
I'm such a mess.
Like, I'm such a hot mess. And so it's, you know, I'm just in my slutty era or whatever. It's kind of like funny. And it's like, particularly if you're a man, it's kind of like a, you know, a, it heightens your masculinity in some way. But I want to ask you, what was it that drew you to writing about that subject in particular, as opposed to another form of sexual assault, I suppose, and like really zoning in on that? And how did you kind of, how did you weave that into Jade's story while also protecting yourself? Because that is a difficult thing to write about. And 100%. I can say that with experience.
100%. I always knew I wanted to write about assault. And as you say, there are so many kind of ways in which assault can manifest. But I landed on blackout sex because I ultimately wanted to get under the skin of a reader's like unconscious bias towards victim blaming. Back to when I first started drinking and alcohol first started becoming like a part of my life, there was like so much messaging around like, you know, never leave your drink unattended, always keep the top of your drink covered, never let like a strange man buy you a drink. And, you know, this it's just created this sort of like onus on you to be really, really vigilant on your own about your own safety. And ultimately, if you find yourself in an unsafe situation, the implication of all of that messaging is, well, how did you get yourself into that scenario? And then another obviously big element about blackout sex is it's the sort of lack of memory about it. And oftentimes it takes survivors, you know, it comes back to them either in fragments or in snapshots, or it takes, you know, months or weeks for that to come back to them, if ever. And that was something I really wanted to explore through Jade and through, you know, the sort of pacing of the novel, that sort of really like slow, horrifying realization of what's happened to you. And it's something that's just used to discredit survivors all the time. Like that, like, you know, how are we meant to believe you if you don't even remember it yourself, kind of thing. So I just really wanted to challenge a reader in how they feel about those kind of things and kind of create as much conflict as possible for them as they're reading it as to how they're seeing this all play out.
And what was it like for you to write all of that and to kind of protect yourself while doing that? Because it is a very difficult kind of psychological space to step into.
100%. I probably didn't safeguard myself that much. I think I felt this enormous like burden and like responsibility to portray it like as fairly and as honestly as possible. But I probably, wasn't too, I like lost myself in it a bit, I guess. Which again, I wouldn't necessarily recommend anyone do. But yeah, that's kind of how I ended up with it. But I think that sort of quite like pent up energy does come across in Jaded as a result.
Yeah, I think it does. I think you really get that sense in the character because, and I can understand why it's something that you wrote so quickly, because I feel like it's subject matter that is so difficult to talk about with friends and talk about with family and kind of have those very difficult, very exposing conversations, it's almost sometimes easier to just kind of like get it all down on paper and just kind of get it out there. And yeah, it does really come across in the character. One of the things that you I think touch on really well is the kind of like nice guy myth, where it's something that, you know, Emerald Fennell talked about in Promising Young Woman, where, you know, she very, which is a film about sexual violence, and she was very careful to employ actors who we kind of know mostly associated with those like very kind of kind, charismatic, kind of soft male characters. So people like Adam Brody, who was obviously most known for playing Seth Cohen in The OC, who's like a totally harmless character. And she would cast these men as rapists, which I think was a really clever move that kind of subverted our expectations of these guys and showed that anyone is capable of rape. And I think that's what you've done with this book, with the character of Josh, because at the start, that kind of first scene, there is this kind of creepy older like boss who is kind of predatory and seems like the obvious predator. But it's not him. So tell me about that decision and how you came about creating the character of Josh and what you're kind of consciously trying to convey there.
Yeah. So in my experience of just having these conversations with people, you know, around me, I think when people hear the word rape, or specifically the label rapist, they like want to believe that it's something really far away. Like they want to believe that only somebody so monstrous and so evil would do something like that. And if I believe that, then I don't need to meaningfully examine the people that are in my immediate circle. And I think if you asked a lot of men, they would probably say like, oh, I would never assault someone, and I don't know anyone who would. Like, none of my friends would do that. But then one in three women have been assaulted, and a huge majority of that, the perpetrator is known to the victim. So someone is doing it, and someone we know is doing it. And I think that's a bit too close to home for a lot of people, because I think engaging with that and those numbers inherently means coming to face to face with the likelihood that either you or someone you immediately know has been assaulted or has assaulted somebody. And people, that's just something so uncomfortable to sit with, that I think people would much rather just say, oh, it's these horrible monsters who, you know, we would never come into contact with. And it's not the nice guys that we know. It's not our friends and our brothers and our, you know, co-workers or whatever. So I think I just wanted to just like turn that upside down a bit and just say like, look, like if so many women are being assaulted on a regular basis, then someone in their lives are doing it.
Yeah, it's wild because we're, you know, what is it, like 6 years on from Me Too now? And I think that, like you said, there are some perpetrators that we are very happy to accept as perpetrators, like someone like Harvey Weinstein. And it's not just because he's, you know, in prison. It's because he looks like a Disney villain, you know? He looks like, I don't want to say a troll, but he doesn't look like a good person, I don't think. He doesn't look like a kind of Prince Charming character, to stay on the Disney metaphor. But what is interesting to me is like those Prince Charming characters are also out there sexually assaulting women. Yeah. Because like you said, do the math. Like one in three women have been raped. Every man you talk to, no, I've never. Well, obviously you have, because how does that work? So I just wonder, like, now, what difference has Me Too really made to the conversations that we're having? Because a part of me wants to, you know, obviously be like, yes, we've obviously made huge leaps and bounds and there's been so much progression. But if anything, a part of me also thinks that it's highlighted how far we still have to go.
100%. I agree. I think Me Too was obviously like this enormous cultural landslide, right? Like nothing quite to that scale had happened before. But I do think when you shine such a bright light on an issue like that, and particularly when it comes to misconduct and abuse, it doesn't go away. It just tends to shy away from the light and kind of operate now in the shadows a bit more. And what I've found quite sinister is that, like, particularly from like an institutional perspective, they seem to have like really absorbed like the language of Me Too and the sort of like language of safeguarding women and, you know, protecting women against violence and all this stuff. But then, like, underneath that initial kind of veneer, like, the actual system is still chugging along. It's just evolved and kind of mutated a bit. And that was something that I think I really wanted to explore through the character of Eve in Jaded, who gets embroiled in this sort of semi-relationship with this guy who is the head of her team, and he's a lot more senior to her. And he sends out all these like International Women's Day emails, and he's like, let's break the glass ceiling, guys. But then behind closed doors is like really pressurizing her to be part of this relationship that she doesn't want to be a part of. And one thing that happened quite later on in the edits is I added like a line of Eve saying, well, I can't say that I didn't consent. Like, I can't say that he forced me into it. I just felt so pressured and I feel like my hands are tied. So that's kind of what I mean when I say, like, the behavior is still there. It's just the lines have just become a bit more fuzzy, and it's just become a lot harder to pin down and evidence, which if anything makes it, I think, maybe a bit more sinister.
Yeah. It does. And I also think a rapist is never going to recognize themselves as a rapist.
No.
Because of the connotations with that word. And like you said, because we just think of it as this really far away thing. And I think, unfortunately, until that changes, very little is going to change in terms of violence against women stats and how systemic this is. But one of the things that I think you touch on in the book that, again, is something that I don't read much about, and it's not something that I've touched on in my novel because my main character is single. She's not in a long-term relationship. And I think it's so interesting reading about it happening to Jade, who has this long-term boyfriend who, you know, you would think is her biggest support through something as traumatizing as that and is her biggest kind of like emotional clutch for all of that. But what is, and weirdly, I had this conversation with a friend the other day about how surprising it can be to experience the reactions of those closest to you when you talk about sexual violence, and particularly a male partner. And I think, and I've definitely had conversations with men in my life that have, and their reaction to what I've told them has happened to me has really shocked me.
Yeah.
Because I think you always think, well, they're the one person that I'm not going to have to justify myself to and is not going to make me feel like any shame for what I'm explaining to them. But it just shows you how deeply entrenched all of this stuff really is. So what was it that made you want to explore that? And why do you think that Jade's boyfriend does react the way that he does?
I have had similar conversations, and it is quite surprising because I think a lot of these men are quite liberal and they would consider themselves very progressive and they would probably call themselves feminists, you know? But ultimately, when faced with a situation, just do not have the skills at all to be supportive or provide adequate support. I think it boils down to a real lack of understanding that manifests itself as a lack of empathy. You know, when you think about depictions of assault in media and film and TV, it tends to be sort of like this one single event that's like suspended in this like vacuum, and it's just like this like blip in the storyline, and then everyone moves on and the news cycle moves on and the plot moves on, and just like no one seems to pay that much attention to the aftermath and how, like, the grief you feel when you've been assaulted and just the nitty-gritty day-to-day living with something like that happening to you. And as a result, there's no education about it and there's no way in which people know how to support them, because we've been kind of taught it's just done, like, it's done, kind of move on. And I think that's where, like, what I really wanted to do through the character of Kit and their relation, his relationship with Jade, was to take this one event and sort of like situate it within the context of an entire life, because so rarely do we think about the lives of the victims and how they're going to continue on and how they move through their lives afterwards. And I think relationships is kind of like one of the sort of key vehicles that will probably be affected.
It's just something that isn't talked about in the way that it needs to be talked about. And I think, like you mentioned, popular culture, I think historically rape has kind of been used as shorthand for just like extreme violence rather than what it actually is. And it's sort of like used for dramatic effect rather than exploring the kind of psychological and emotional ramifications of it, which is why I think books like this are so important and, you know, hopefully do a lot of work in terms of educating people more about the realities of it. I want to ask, what is it like for you now that the book is done? Presumably a lot of people have read it and given you feedback.
Yeah.
What has that experience been like for you and talking about it and now putting it out there into the world? Because it is obviously such an intense subject matter to write about. And now it's out there. How do you feel about it being, you know, being birthed, I suppose?
I feel like on the one hand, very, very vulnerable. Just because it's, I think whenever you talk about assault, you're exposing yourself to people kind of projecting their idea onto you. And I know, particularly as a debut author, you should never do this, but every now and then I'll like kind of dip into the reviews and then very quickly dip back out again. The few reviews that I have read, like some of them are like wonderful, beautiful, like thoughtful and considered reviews. But every now and then, you know, you read a review and you're like, you've just validated why I felt like I had to write this book. Like,
oh, really?
Like one review was like, I don't know why it took Jade so long to face the obvious that she was raped. And you're like, this is why we as a society just need to understand that it takes people sometimes like decades to like look back and think, wow, if that happened to me now, I would so react so differently. I feel kind of, just not justified, but like validated in kind of the choices I made for the plot, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. I think the not reporting thing is very much so a big issue just societally, but also something that I think the book really will help people understand as to why women don't come forward, because the majority statistically don't, and those who do statistically won't get a conviction because, that is the justice system that we operate within.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
But let's move on to talk about the loves of your life. So your first one is a place. So tell me why you have chosen this. What is it? Introduce it to us.
So I chose Seoul as my first love. And the context is I'm Korean and I grew up, I've never lived in Seoul, but I went there quite a lot as a child, kind of pretty much every year. And I have no family in the UK other than my immediate parents. And so going to Seoul was like the only real time that I got to interact with, you know, my cousins and my aunts and, you know, just extended family. And it just feels like kind of landing in Seoul feels to me just like a breath of fresh air, like this whole sort of half of my identity that I quite rarely get to kind of explore when I'm here in London. Just it gets like unleashed the moment I get there, and I get to like speak the language and have the food and just kind of really connect with it in a way that I don't usually in my life here. And I find it quite funny because when I was growing up, like when I was like 6 or 7, you know, I went to a new school and they say like, tell me about yourself. And I would say I'm Korean, and people would genuinely be like, where? Like people would be like, where's that? Like, is that Japan? Like all this stuff. And like, there was just such a like monolithic view of like Asia as a whole. Mm. And I remember even like when I was at uni, like going to Seoul over some over the summer holidays, and someone was like, but I don't understand, like, why would you go to Korea?
Really?
And like, you contrast that now with like K-beauty and, yeah, you know, K-dramas and K-pop, and like Korean culture has just like burst onto the scene, which is obviously like amazing and really great for me to see. But it's like this really like weird disconnect between like the experience that I have with being Korean and then the career that's kind of like being presented to the world.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the book, isn't there a moment when Jade is asked, where are you from? And she says, London. Mm. And they say, where are you really from?
Yeah, something like that. But she, there's kind of lots of like microaggressions like that sort of throughout, yeah, the book.
When you find yourself in London, kind of craving that sense of, I guess, belonging, which is what it is that you're describing when you go back to Seoul, even though you've never lived there, if you have that, do you have that London, do you have that kind of sense of like displacement in London? And if you have that, what do you do to kind of remedy that? Because you can't just hop on a plane. Is what,
yeah,
I mean.
I think this is something that's like so inherent with being mixed race, but also being like coming from like an immigrant family, is that I don't feel displaced in London. I grew up in London, and London is my home. But equally, you know, I don't feel like all of myself is represented in London. And I don't feel like, you know, you go around London and you see like Korean inspired dishes or like gochujang inspired sauce and all this stuff, and you feel like, oh, is it being tokenized to some extent now that it's popular? Back when I was a child, it was actually something that people kind of made fun of you for.
Your second love is an animal. Well, two animals. Mm-hmm. Tell us why you have chosen. Who are these animals? Tell us who they are and what, yeah, they mean to you. And also, I should say, I have a cat. I'm mm-hmm. very big into the animal thing. Very big into the pet thing. I totally get it. So whatever you say, it's not going to sound crazy. I understand.
So my animals are Lucy, who was my childhood dog, and is the only reason I believe in an afterlife, because I just hope that one day Lucy and I are reunited. And Bo is my current dog. And Lucy was this like 2 kilogram, like untrainable, feral, like ball of yappiness, basically. But I just adored her. Like, I just adored everything about her. And I was an only child, or I am an only child. So I think I maybe just developed this like extremely close attachment to her. And I think like, I don't know, pet loss and pet grief is something that, you know, unless you've experienced that, people maybe don't take it as seriously, but it does feel like you've lost like a family member.
People really don't take it very seriously. I remember I read a book about how to heal from heartbreak. It's brilliant. In the book, I remember it's split into two, and it's kind of half of it is about heartbreak from, you know, a breakup. Mm. And the other half is heartbreak from losing an animal. Mm. And I remember skipping over all of these bits being like, I just don't get it. Like, what? Why is this such a big deal? Now I have a cat. Yeah. Oh my God, I totally understand. Yeah. And I think it's a real, like, it's a real indictment to society that we can't talk about that more openly and like 100%. With real empathy, because it is obviously huge. And it's, you know, those animals, particularly a childhood animal you grow up with, it becomes like a real lifeline. And I imagine if you're an only child as well, becomes like almost like a kind of furry little sibling.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I don't know. I get really like preemptive anxiety about losing Beau now. Like I'll I don't know, like if I don't know, hypothetically I'm talking about like when I'm in my 40s, I'll like get really upset at the notion that he's not going to be here.
I mean, all the time, literally like, all the time. And yeah. Like in my mind, I'm like, how old am I going to be? When will she live till, my cat's called Blanche. Like, when, how old will I be when I have Blanche? Okay, will I be able to cope with it then? I don't know. At what stage? Maybe I'll have a child by then. Maybe that'll help.
Yeah, no, seriously. It is like the attachment I feel. And I also have this like horrible habit of like, when my friends or former colleagues like talk about their babies, I'll like join in the conversation and talk about my dog, which is just like, I need to just stop doing that.
Yeah, I do that as well. How did Beau come into your life? How long have you had Beau for?
2 years. It was just kind of quite serendipitous because my partner said we couldn't get a dog until the book thing was kind of off our plates because we were both working full-time jobs. I was writing a book at the same time and I also really wanted a dog. And he was like, no, like this just can't happen. And then I got the book deal and then Beau became available and we brought him home probably like a week later. No one wanted him because he is an Aussie Shepherd and he doesn't have the blue eyes.
Which is supposed to have blue eyes.
They're supposed to have blue eyes. Oh. And that's how we came to have him because no one else wanted him.
Oh.
Which obviously made me love him even more.
Yeah, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
How do you split domestic responsibilities with your partner? Because having a dog is a big...
I will say he does most of the walking and definitely all of the like poop scooping.
Excellent.
And I do all the like training, and especially not so much anymore, but right at the beginning there was like a lot of like teething and like training that needed to be done, so I did all of that. I like to think that I'm like the strategy person, mm-hmm. and he's like the execution person.
And I think the thing that I is always strikes me about having an animal is how in tune they are with you emotionally, and they can be such an emotional clutch and emotional support. Do you think, can Beau tell when you're going through something?
It's so creepy.
Really?
So if the like tone of my voice or the pitch of my voice like in any way increases, even if I'm like having like an animated conversation or if I'm like getting a bit stressed or a bit anxious, he will literally put his entire body weight on me.
Really?
Like it's so weird. He'll just like approach from like another room and just like launch on me and won't stop. Oh. Won't get off me until I like go back to my normal tone of voice.
No way.
And I don't know where he picked that up from. But,
so he just like tries to hug you, basically.
Yeah, literally. It's amazing because it's
That's so sweet.
I don't know where he picked that up from, but it's really helpful. Like really helpful.
Does he do that with your partner as well?
No.
Really?
Not at all. But then I work from home now because I'm writing. Right, okay. So I'm with him like pretty much all the time.
Okay.
So I think he's just a lot more like sensitive to me. And I'm quite like a up and down person anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Oh, that sounds like the best. And well, this leads me on to your third love, which is therapy. But mm-hmm. you have said you have quite an on-off relationship with it, which is something I can totally relate to. I have been in and out of therapy since 2020, gone through maybe like 6 or 7 different therapists. Very much an on-off thing. Tell me why you chose therapy and why it is so on-off for you.
My first ever experience with therapy was when I was at uni. And I was really, really lucky because it was, I got a few sessions and it was paid for, or the cost of it was covered by the uni. And then sort of for the next 3 or 4 years, it was like really stop start. I was kind of like, I think when you're in your early 20s and you're living in London and, you know, all your friends are there, there are so many more fun ways to dull your pain than going to therapy. Mm-hmm. Like, therapy just felt like the path of most resistance. So I just couldn't really make it stick. And I kept treating it like a bit of like a plaster. So like I'd get into these like extremely bad states of mind and I'd find a therapist and then see them for like 4 or 5 sessions and then kind of feel like I was like back on track again and then I'd drop it again.
Yeah, I wonder with that, is it that you think, because obviously it's very appealing to have a couple sessions and think, oh, I'm fine now. I'm totally fine. I'm fixed. Thank you so much. I'll see you later. Do you think the point is when you get to that stage, keep going?
It is 100% the point. It's sort of like the first few sessions are sort of inherently cathartic because you're like meeting someone for the first time and you are telling them all this context that they need to know to be able to help you. But then at least for me, I felt like the sort of like pressure valve release once I'd kind of let it all out. And then I was like, oh, okay, I feel better now. And then it would just be dropped again. So it took quite a few years to like actually do it consistently and kind of actually commit the time and like the expense of it. Like there's a huge kind of financial barrier to entry for that, which also was a huge kind of mental block for me as well.
Mm. How do you think being in therapy has informed your writing? Because I always think that that's super interesting in terms of creating characters.
Mm-hmm.
I am kind of thinking about their psychology a bit more and thinking about like their childhood trauma and how that has shaped who they are. Is that informing like how you create characters in your work?
Not really for Jaded, but for my second book for sure, because my second book's all about mothers and like complicated relationships between mothers and daughters. And it is biographically like so different from my life, but a lot of the like learnings from that and just like family dynamics, I think, have informed my writing in that sense. I actually listened to Candace Carty-Williams on How to Fail, and she was saying that once she started going to therapy, she was scared that like she'd addressed her trauma so much that like maybe she wouldn't be able to write anymore, which I thought was like such an interesting, like really funny take. But yeah, I think it does help in terms of like character building and also just kind of creating complex flawed characters, which are always more interesting to read.
You mentioned your second book, so now obviously I want to ask you about that. Tell me what can you tell us about that, and what made you want to write about something that you say is so different to Jaded, and how has that writing process been different for you as well?
So I'm not sure how much I can say, but it's set in 2008, post the recession, and a family's been hit really, really hard by it, and they have to like significantly downsize their entire life to be able to make ends meet, and as a result, kind of they're living on top of each other and sort of chaos ensues. I always knew that this was going to be my second book. It was the kind of story that I'd pitched when we'll be going out on submission to sell Jaded. I think I just wanted to write something really, really different because I feel like, you know, there's this kind of cliche of like your debut is like the culmination of everything you've thought and felt in like one kind of product.
Yeah.
And then your second book is kind of the book that you really think about and that you really kind of allow yourself the like headspace to write properly.
Yeah.
And I do kind of feel that way. I feel like Jaded was like just very, very deeply like emotional and was very important to me. Whereas the second book is a lot more like, this is the book that I actually want to write.
Yeah. Versus the book that I feel like I must write
and
get. Yeah. I totally know what you mean. Well, I can't wait for it to be out into the world and for everyone to read it. If you haven't already read it, because by the time this comes out, it will be out. So do go and read it now. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for joining us. If you are a fan of Love Lives, you can catch up with the show on all major podcast platforms. You can also watch us on independent TV and all social media platforms. Thank you so much, and I will see you next time. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.